Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 2 years ago, the Lakers and the Angels both came first. Those champions were neighbors, and the list, which I've rehearsed, contains as well the Niners and the A's just up the coast. In 89, those teams combined to be, no doubt, the toast of football and of baseball. 20 years before that date, the Jets and Mets pulled off another double that was great, at least if you lived in New York. States and cities have sometimes enjoyed dual champions, but how often have two teams owned by the same person ever won two championships in the same year? Detroit Pistons owner Bill Davidson may accomplish that this spring because his company, Palace Sports and Entertainment, also holds the Tampa Bay Lightning, the NHL champs, as well as the reigning WNBA champs, the Detroit Shock. Some company. Palace President Tom Wilson joins me now on the line from his trophy-laden office in Detroit. Mr. Wilson, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you, and that's a wonderful introduction. It feels good when somebody else says it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All your recent success notwithstanding, I think we should start by revealing that Palace Sports also owns the Detroit Fury of the Arena Football League. They went 5-11 this year, missed the playoffs. Has to be a misprint, right?
Yes, but if it makes anybody feel any better, last year we also own a big piece of the Tampa Bay Storm in the same league, and I'm wearing a ring from their championship last year. So we're actually going for four championship rings in 12 months, and that's a record that nobody has ever approached. So it's kind of fun.
It's probably safe, too.
I think it might be.
The Detroit Pistons currently enjoy a 2-1 lead over the Lakers. They are as close to an NBA championship as they've been in 15 years. Should Detroit win, will the success of your teams be a source of continuing pride, or at some point do you get embarrassed by all these riches?
Oh, I'd love to find out. I don't think you get embarrassed by it at all. It is a remarkable sort of achievement, particularly as you mentioned in your intro. We're 1,000 miles away from our satellite property down in Tampa Bay, and I think it speaks volumes about Bill Davidson, who is our principal owner, that you can sort of have success on so many fronts at so many times. But we were fortunate enough in Tampa that when we went down there and purchased that property, we took a lot of, say, our number two people in different departments here in Detroit and sort of said, here's your opportunity. You know, you wanted to stretch. You're behind somebody here in Detroit. Let's take these same philosophies that we've had some success in, transfer them down to another city, and then let's see how it works. Let's see if we can sort of recreate history and grow this again, like you're transplanting a hosta or something like that. And for 3 years, it was just agony, and it was awful and terrible and bleeding us to death. And then last year it started to make some sense, and this year, of course, you win the championship. You can't do it without throwing tons of money at it, but to take an empty cupboard and 5 years later be flying a banner is an impossible thing to do, and so we take tremendous pride in what's happened.
Back in December of 2002, Only a Game ran a story on the Lightning in which head coach John Tortorella described the team he came to as a coach as, quote, a comedy club. Was it really that bad just 4 years ago?
Well, if you really look to how we got into this, it started with a cover story on Sports Illustrated, the worst franchise in professional sports. And I don't know if it was worst franchise forever or if it was just the worst at this particular time. But it was mismanaged. They had no money. It was Japanese ownership, and the ownership had never even been to America, much less to Tampa. And then they'd run out of money, and so every good player they ever drafted, they had to trade just to stay afloat. And so, yes, it was as empty a cupboard. And was it a comedy club? I don't know. But I do know if you were a veteran player who had had a good career and you were traded to Tampa, the thing you were most concerned about was, where is the nearest golf course? And boy, I can work on my tan.
Your company paid over $100 million for that empty cupboard. What do you suppose that investment is worth now? And how did you know when you looked at such an unpromising team that it would be redeemable?
Well, yeah, I think we were we might have been wrong. I mean, today we can look back and say, oh, we knew it all along. In those days, and you remember it was 5 years ago, you had stupid money flying around the country because you were in the middle of the dot-com era, and people were worth a fortune even if they had no money. So we bought it on what would be called the cheap, because it was a brand-new building, which we got rights to, real estate all around it that could be developed, and then you had a team that was underperforming, and we were arrogant enough to think that we'd had success in Detroit. We can apply the same principles here. But the dot-com crash happened. 9/11 happened. The economy crashed. And so the values of teams are not what they used to be. It was a team that had lost $40 million a year before we took it over. It's break-even now, and it may not be worth what it was when we bought it.
With the Lightning having been so successful, the Pistons banging their way toward a championship perhaps, and of course the WNBA is in action, how do you keep track of all these teams? Do you have some system of complicated electronics that allows you and Mr. Davidson to stay abreast of what's going on?
It is very much like being on a cruise and wondering every morning what's on the agenda today. But what a wonderful problem. I mean, we've never in a million years envisioned that the hockey team and the basketball team would be creating a problem for us, because which team do we want to go see tonight? The tough part is that you can't totally enjoy it, because you win tonight in hockey, but there's a basketball game tomorrow, and you win the basketball game, but you lose the hockey game, oh my gosh, and then you win the basketball, you're kind of up again. And so there is sort of, sports has this Sisyphean quality where you just keep fighting and pushing, and then you get slapped back, and you fight again, and you keep getting slapped back. And everybody said, aren't you tired? And you say, what a wonderfully sweet agony it is to be tired chasing your teams around, watching them strive for the ultimate in their respective sports. And so you just suck it all in, and wherever your secretary says you're supposed to be, that's where you go.
Tom Wilson is president of Palace Sports and Entertainment, the parent company of the Detroit Fury, the Stanley Cup champion Tampa Bay Lightning, the WNBA champion Detroit Shock, and perhaps the soon-to-be NBA champion Detroit Pistons. Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, nice talking to you.
At about 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, Joe Oversa, the batting practice pitcher for the San Diego Padres, is sitting in the visitors' dugout at Fenway Park, staring out at the green wall that looms over left field. He's thinking history.
You go look and there's dents, there's a million dents in the wall out there from balls that have hit it, and just, hey, who hit that one and who hit it? It's just really just the history. I mean, the Red Sox have so much history, and it's a lot to take in. It's pretty neat.
Temptation to go into the locker room and get a pool together about who can dent the wall tonight?
I hope we do it a lot.
As it turned out, the Padres did not dent the wall on Wednesday night, and neither did the Red Sox. The game ended 1-0, Boston. The Padres were in town as part of Major League Baseball's annual round of interleague competition, an 8-year-old phenomenon that still irritates some baseball purists who feel competition between the leagues should be saved for the World Series. Most of the players, on the other hand, shrug off the regular season games against teams from the other league as business as usual now, and some of the National Leaguers have enjoyed its various advantages, among them the opportunity to fill the pitcher's spot in the lineup as designated hitters. Padres batting coach Dave Magadan played for 7 different major league teams, 5 of them in the National League, before ending his career in San Diego in 2001.
I know when I was at the end of my career and we go into an American League park and I knew I was going to DH, it was kind of nice, you know, to know that I was going to get some at-bats. I think the majority of the guys really don't pay it much attention. They're just, you know, they're just happy to get their at-bats and not have to worry about playing defense.
Maybe it's been Dave Magadan's advice around the cage, or perhaps it's been Joe Oversa grooving 3/4 speed fastballs during batting practice, but this year's Padres are off to a promising start. They came into the second week of June tied with the Dodgers for first place in the National League West. 6 Padres regulars were hitting .280 or better, among them first baseman Phil Nevin, who feels that one difference between this year's Padres and the last few San Diego teams is that this club is physically sound.
Well, that's been a big part, obviously, staying healthy. But, you know, I think our bullpen is something we haven't had here. And you know, since I've been here, it's been pretty comforting knowing with a lead we're going to do well late.
Closer Trevor Hoffman has led the Padres' bullpen. Coming into the Boston series, he'd converted 15 save opportunities into 14 saves. Another one of the relievers making Phil Nevin more comfortable has been Akinori Otsuka, who came to the Padres from Japan's Chunichi Dragons. In Bruce Bochy, the Padres also feature the only major league manager born in France, though Bochy refuses to attribute any significance to that bit of trivia.
Well, you know, if I grew up in France, I'd say that, but my father's in the service. I don't even remember anything about France. I moved there when I was 2 years old, but that's the thing about our game now. It's become so global. I mean, we're seeing players on our club. We have them from Japan, from Dominican, Puerto Rico, every, you know, part of the world, and it's only getting bigger and bigger.
Bochy, who has been managing in San Diego since 1995, has presided over a succession of discouraging teams. Since the Padres finished atop their division and reached the World Series in 98, then got swept by the Yankees. Last season, his club finished fifth for the third time in 4 years, winning only 64 games. But Bochy says this season's success is no fluke.
Well, we're a different club than last year. We have a lot of new faces here. David Wells, we've got Jay Payton, Terrence Long, Khalil Green. We're healthy. Hoffman and Nevin are healthy. We've got Ramon Hernandez from Oakland. So it's a different club. I think we're a much improved club offensively, defensively. And I think that's why we're where we're at. So it's going to be a tight race in our division, but we certainly like our chances.
At this point in the season, Bruce Bochy's contention may be something more than bluster. The Padres are in one of the two divisions where staying 6 or 7 games over 500 has been good enough for first place. Elsewhere in the National League West, Felipe Alou's Giants stumbled out of the gate. The Dodgers have been inconsistent, and Arizona and Colorado have aspired unsuccessfully for inconsistent. Still this weekend, the Padres may be feeling at least a little disadvantaged. While the interleague schedule pitted the Padres against the second-place Red Sox, the Giants were playing the last-place Devil Rays in Tampa, and the Dodgers were up against the fifth-place Blue Jays in Toronto. And today and tomorrow, all the Padres have to do is beat the Yankees in New York. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Cora Schumacher, the wife of Formula One racing driver Ralph Schumacher, made her racing debut last weekend in two Mini Cooper races. Ms. Schumacher finished 18th in one race and 13th in the other, and her pre-race preparation encouraged former driver Eller Lohr to ridicule Schumacher's efforts. Regarding Ms. Schumacher's decision to enhance her figure with breast implants, Ms. Lohr opined, quote, "No real driver would take an additional twice 400 grams of extra weight along in the car. If she gets into a crash, her breasts might burst. I don't know if that's what she wants." Granted, I don't know much about auto racing, but I don't think that's what Ms. Schumacher wants. I mean, who would want that? I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. After a 30-year hiatus, a former school principal has her heartstrings plucked by bowstrings and returns to competitive archery. But first, the American Basketball Association is perhaps best remembered for Dr. J, afros the size of hot air balloons, and for its attempt to supersede the NBA as the world's preeminent pro hoops league, before Magic Larry and Michael rendered such behavior pure folly. The original ABA operated from 1967 to 1976, but it was revived in the year 2000. The league's ambitious plan now is to expand from 7 teams to 31 teams and to include a squad which will be comprised solely of Native Americans. Joining me now on the line from Buffalo, New York, en route to Toronto to discuss the new team is basketball veteran Spider Ledesma, the principal owner, CEO, and president of the ABA's Native America, which will begin play this fall in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mr. Ledesma, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
In recent years, lots of people have written about the way basketball has been embraced by people living on reservations all over the U.S. To what extent is this phenomenon responsible for the idea you've got to put this team together?
It's a large part. I mean, the first credit goes to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. He gave me this vision about 7 years ago, and it's because we have 186 Native American high schools throughout the United States, And a large number of them, the only major sport they offer still is basketball. Many of them are on smaller reservations that don't have football teams and or baseball teams, even though certainly that's changing. But basketball is the sport in our community. There's nothing akin to it or equal to it. It enjoys a very lofty status.
Will the players who make your team see this as a genuine career opportunity, or will they, as is so often the case with minor league athletes, need to work another job to make ends meet?
No, this will definitely be a career opportunity, and that is the goal, that after the ABA season, which is approximately a 4.5 to 5 month season, that then because of our revenue turnover and profitability, that we can turn into a year-long program. Our ultimate goal is to go to the Olympics in 2008 as a sovereign nation. We know we can do that. We can challenge the IOC through the state of California and the legal courts there. So my goal is to develop a year-round program with the gentleman, sending them abroad immediately after the ABA season to go against international competition. And in the meantime, we'll be meeting with several Olympic committee bodies to gain their acceptance of us being included in the 2008 Olympics and explain to them why we should be there.
The announcement this week that there would be such a team has generated publicity not only for your team, but also for the on-again, off-again ABA, the league itself. Is it incorrect to assume that publicity is the main reason for the decision to construct an all-Native American team?
Yes. I mean, first of all, the ABA and Chairman Joe Newman have just been wonderful to us. The fact is they contacted us about 6 months ago when they understood that we had a Native American national team, because one of the backbones of the ABA is written into their corporate bylaws is diversification of team representation and ownership. So this coming year, there'll be an all-Chinese team, predominantly all-Chinese team playing out of Vancouver. There's three now Mexican teams. There was two this year. There was a third one added out of Mexico. So they have been just wonderful to us. We can't thank them enough, because the ABA is enjoying a nice spot within the media, and it's that exposure that is allowing people to understand who we are, what we're doing. And it's really generating a lot of excitement, not only within the Native American community, but the mainstream community as well.
Well, this is fascinating to me because it's unimaginable, it seems to me, that an all-white team could be created or an all-African-American team that wouldn't let white folks play. Do you think an all-Native American team will be embraced by the public without any sort of controversy?
Well, with everything, there's always going to be a little controversy. We keep our focus on the good things and the positive reviews. And we have overwhelming support from mainstream America as well as other parts of the world. The fact is we have been an invisible people, even up here into the third millennium in many respects, and we're using sport as a way to show our culture not only to the American mainstream community and society, but to the international community as well, and simply put, our best foot forward and showing others that we're a very can-do people. And this is just in line with having other national teams, whether they be of Greek ethnic background or Chinese or Italian or whatnot. So we're simply doing ours as North American Indians.
There's been a good deal of controversy in recent years regarding the way Native Americans have been depicted by sports teams, and particularly college and university programs with the mascots and nicknames that they've had. What is your position on this, and will you take advantage of this as an opportunity to represent Native Americans in a different way?
Well, I've been asked that question often, and quite frankly, I really don't get into that. I mean, I'm not offended by it. You know, if somebody was to make an off-color remark, it wouldn't matter who it was. If it was against white people, that I would be offended by. The fact is, I'd like to think that they do that as a form of respect. And if they do or they don't, you know, that's not for me to worry about. I have my focus here with the team, and we're simply going to go forward. There are Native Americans with our own community that we're having to work with and deal with that are somewhat racist towards the outside world because of past hurts by the United States government and others. And I've told them that we simply have to forgive people and the Lord, move on, and in doing so, God will bless us. And we just need to learn how to reach out and love people of all ethnic backgrounds, of all sexual persuasions, of all lifestyles. You know, it's not up to us to judge, but it is up to us to be inclusive of all people and their backgrounds and just root for them, and hopefully in turn they'll root for us.
Spider Ledesma is the principal owner, CEO, and president of the ABA's Native America. He joined me on the line from Buffalo, New York. Spider, thank you for talking with me.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate it.
It's not uncommon for pro football players to hang up their cleats in their 20s. Highly drafted NBA players often wash out in just a year or two. But as Nick Roman reports, there's at least one sport in which athletes 30, 40, and older can find their groove.
All right, Phyllis Shipman can't avoid the obvious, so she doesn't.
I'm a little older than some of my colleagues here.
That's not exactly true. A little older is, say, Karl Malone being 17 years older than his youngest Laker teammate. Phyllis Shipman's youngest teammate on the U.S. Women's National Archery Team is 40 years younger than she is, and nobody on the women's team had even been born when she first picked up a bow and arrow in the early 1950s.
Well, I shot when I went to summer camp, Camp Tulewocket, and from about like maybe 8 to 12 years old.
Wait a minute. Camp what?
Tulewocket. It's in Vermont. They had one of the best archery programs in the country, but of course, what did I know?
She knew enough after Camp Tulewocket to stick with competitive archery through college at the University of Pennsylvania.
It is all about the mental energy for me. It gets to be kind of addictive, that good feeling.
And then she quit, cold turkey, for more than 30 years. Instead, Phyllis Shipman got married, raised a family in Hawaii, became a school teacher, then a school principal, then a retired school principal. And one day, on a visit to Kona with her husband Chuck, she spotted a sporting goods store in a shopping center.
So I just went in there, and they had, you know, all kinds of hunting gear, including bows and arrows. And I thought, oh, I used to do this. And I thought, maybe I'd like to do it again, you know. And so I went and I bought a bow and arrow and started shooting again. And one thing led to another.
That was 6 years ago.
She came out here. She just kind of started it, I think, more for fun and came out for a training camp one time.
That's Lloyd Brown, Phyllis's coach.
She looked pretty good, like she had the ability to be a good shooter, and we kind of encouraged her a little bit.
Why encourage a middle-aged archer to move from senior competition to the U.S. national team? Because in this sport, age is virtually meaningless. Ed Eliason, perhaps the greatest American archer ever, made his first Olympic team 32 years ago and has competed for more than 50 years. Janet Dykeman, who made the last two Olympic teams, will try to make her third this year at age 54. So archer John Burkett, all of 21 years old, says Phyllis was more than welcome on the U.S. team, especially among the younger archers who like using her as a target.
Target of a lot of jokes?
Yeah, is that true?
From time to time. Well, we just basically...
She was a school principal, you know.
Yeah, I never really liked those. But we basically just, we include her in everything we do. I mean, if we go out to dinner, she comes out to dinner with us or, you know, anything. I mean, we don't lead, you know, enthralling lives by any means, but anything we go do, she'll come along and be just one of the gang, I guess.
But what sets Phyllis Shipman apart from the gang is the fact that she wasn't part of the archery world for such a long time. Long enough that the definition of training had changed. It now means at least 4 hours a day firing arrows at the 70-meter targets on the range at the U.S. Olympic Training Center east of San Diego. It also means time in the weight room.
If you ever talk to Zach Weatherford, who's the head trainer here, he will tell you stories about how I would sort of look into the weight room, and then I'd walk into the weight room, and then I'd look around, and if no one was there, I might talk to him. And, I mean, when you hear him tell the story, it's like he's training a deer. He's come a little closer.
At the Olympic trials that begin Monday in Mason, Ohio, archers will shoot 72 arrows to get through the qualifying rounds, then go one-on-one until somebody wins the round. Only three archers will make the Olympic team in Phyllis Shipman's event. She comes into the trials ranked fifth, but really, she comes into the trials as an equal.
The archery world is a very inviting world, and the people there are very, very supportive. And if you want to shoot and you want to learn, they're more than happy. And your age really doesn't matter.
And in some ways, what happens to Phyllis Shipman next week doesn't matter either. To stand among the best in your sport more than 30 years after you left it, nearly 50 years after you learned it, well, that's a life on target. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Chula Vista, California.
On June 17th, the Cape Cod League will open its 2004 season. Each summer, many of the country's best college baseball players join the Chatham A's, the Orleans Cardinals, and the other clubs that make up the Cape League, which has long been celebrated as a throwback to the days when all the bats were made of wood, which is still the case in the Cape League, and everybody played for the fun of it. In the last best league, Jim Collins tags along for the summer with a Cape League team and tells the stories of some of the players, and he joins me now. Welcome to Only a Game.
happy to be here. Thank you.
The youngsters who get the opportunity to play in the Cape League know that they are potentially on a fast track. So there is, I gather, a fair amount of pressure on these kids to perform.
Yeah, how would you like to be 20 years old and an all-star wherever you've played, and you get to the Cape and suddenly you're surrounded by all-stars wherever they've played? These guys come from great college conferences. They come out of the ACC. They come from the West Coast. And in those conferences, even the good ones, you typically will see a great pitcher once or twice a weekend maybe. And then after that, the quality falls off, and you can fatten your batting average and get your confidence back. In the Cape Cod League, for 44 straight days, more or less, you're seeing a number one pitcher from somewhere around the country. It's relentless. There's no way to take a break or to get your confidence back.
One of the people who becomes a main character in your book is a manager, John Schiffner, a longtime Cape Leaguer. The work is hard, and it certainly complicates his day job. It's not money that brings John Schiffner back summer after summer, and it's not the pursuit of a major league coaching spot. He's long past the time when he would have gotten that. What is the attraction?
You know, John Schiffner coaches high school baseball during the school year, but in the Cape Cod League in the summertime, he becomes one degree away from major league scouts, major league general managers, former players of his who are now in the major leagues. Guys leave tickets in his name at Fenway Park when they come to town. He's a somebody by coaching in this elite summer league. And not coincidentally, he's one of the most successful coaches that league has ever seen. But really, winning isn't what the Cape League is all about. It's about nurturing these guys and seeing what they can do against each other, what they can do with a wooden bat in their hands. And it's really a coming-of-age summer in so many ways. They're 1,000 miles away from home, maybe, some of them for the first time, living with host families and working day jobs during the morning. And John Schiffner will tell you that he gets the greatest pride in seeing guys of his go on and make it in professional baseball.
Baseball games, of course, are made up of moments. I want you to read a passage from the book about one particular moment. This one concerns Jamie D'Antona. Tell me just a little bit about him, and then let's hear you read that passage.
Jamie D'Antona was spectacularly athletic in some cases, and then would absolutely let routine plays eat him alive. And there was a point late in the season when he made a play that I wanted to write about, and I thought that it said a lot about him as both a character and a player.
So that's what we're going to hear about now.
D'Antona sprang to his backhand again for a ground ball skimming along the baseline. The ball kicked into foul territory just before the third base bag. D'Antona reacted, speared it with his glove as he slid on his knees, his momentum carrying him past the far side of the third base coach's box. One out of 50 infielders might have stopped a ball that far into foul territory. Not one in 100 would do what D'Antona did next. He stopped his slide by sticking out his right leg, and jamming in his cleats, pushed off from that low position and gunned a throw all the way to first to beat the runner. The third base umpire threw both hands up in the air, signaling the foul ball, but the fans, primed with tension, went nuts anyway. Husbands came back from the food line, and wives said, "You missed it." Kids playing catch down by the playground tried to reenact the play, sliding on their knees and throwing, sliding on their knees and throwing. Nobody went home early. The crowd seemed to swell as the innings marched on. Kids got a bedtime reprieve from their parents. The game was going to extra innings. The summer refused to end.
Now, it struck me when I read the book that was the baseball moment that gave you your ending. Did you know at the time you saw that play that, oh my goodness, I know where this is going?
Well, I knew that play was something I'd never seen before, but the context of that play was that the Chatham A's that year atypically struggled through a long losing summer, and they hadn't really given the fans the treat that they had come to expect from the A's, which was a great finish and a playoff appearance. And here they were at the very end of the summer playing beautiful baseball and actually winning a game or going into overtime, and that one single evening made me realize that this was a special thing and no one wanted it to end. And seeing a play like that and then knowing the game was headed for extra innings did make it seem like it was an endless summer in the moment.
Having learned what you've learned about the Cape League, will you ever again be able to just wander over to a field in Chatham this summer and happily watch a game?
I can't wait to do that. The power of baseball is not just in the dreams, but I think really in the metaphors. And I did go to a game last summer in Chatham a year after researching the book. And the thing that struck me right away is that a couple of things about the field had changed, and that the volunteers who I got to know looked like they had aged a year. They'd put on a little more weight or they'd gone a little gray. and the players out on the field were still 19 and 20 years old. They hadn't changed at all. And I get the sense that that's part of the power of the Cape League, is that you can have this ritual in your family's life or part of a tradition of your trip to the Cape every summer, where you go to a field and it's timeless because the players themselves never change.
Jim Collins is the author of The Last Best League, subtitled One Summer, One Season, One Dream. It's published by DeCapo Press. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
If you spend an evening, you want to stay, watching the moonlight on Cape Cod Bay. You're sure to fall in love with all Cape Cod. If you spend an evening, you want to stay, watching the moonlight on Cape Cod Bay.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, why track and field fans, and Ethiopians in particular, think highly of Gebre Selassie. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me to comment on the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The mere mention of the Detroit Pistons elicited an immediate blah from you last week. And now the Pistons boast a 2-1 lead in the NBA Finals over the allegedly, quote, greatest ever, unquote, Lakers, even though it should be a 3-0 lead. In retrospect, is blah too strong a word?
I don't care if the Pistons win the series. They still play ugly. They're still a champion the NBA should be embarrassed by. And I think the burial of the Lakers is very premature. I don't care how bad they looked in Game 3. This is still a Detroit team that, if you get them in a close game, does not have a play to run at the end of the game. Once the Lakers understand, finally, that the big Aristotle is the way they win the series, I think they're still going to be fine.
Larry Bird made news this week with comments regarding the racial composition of the NBA. What is your take on the ESPN four-way conversation between Bird, Magic, Carmelo, and LeBron?
Well, Carmelo's been getting around, actually, because he was on Spike TV's Greatest NBA Moments with Bill Walton. And was as baffled by Bill Walton as we all have been by Bill Walton. One of the noblest things Larry Bird did while he was playing in the NBA was fight the overwhelming tendency to turn himself into a great white hope. And given where he grew up in the region of the country where he grew up, the fact that he is as colorblind a human being as I've ever met in sports is all to his credit. That having been said, I think he artlessly expressed, a sub rosa concern in the NBA that is frankly not, to me, is not that great a concern.
The Tampa Bay Lightning won the Stanley Cup on Monday night, Charlie, but I gather you wouldn't necessarily have known it if you picked up the Tampa Tribune on Tuesday morning.
See, this is what happens when you automate newspapers. There's two buttons to push. One that had the editorial saying, good try. This is what we in the business like to call the T-ball editorial. Good try. Way to go. Excellent effort. But you lost.
Right.
Unfortunately, they won. So that one shouldn't have gotten in the newspaper, but it did.
Martin San Luis, Brad Richards, and John Tortorella all took awards home from the NHL's annual postseason ceremony. I like Tampa as the current hotbed of hockey. How about you?
Well, it's going, as we pointed out before, it's going to be the hotbed of hockey for 2 years because there's not going to be any hockey next year. I like the team. The three of them showed up on the Jay Leno show on Thursday night with the cup. But let us not forget that here in Boston, our own Andrew Raycroft was the league's Rookie of the Year. So good on you, Razor, as we hockey guys say.
Yeah, absolutely. And on Wednesday, the Hockey Hall of Fame announced that Ray Bourque had been elected to membership, which gives you an opportunity to place Mr. Bourque among hockey's other glitterati historically.
Yeah, it's big year for defensemen because Paul Coffey, another great defenseman, also is going in the class of 04. If you assume, as I always do, that Bobby Orr is beyond category among defensemen, Ray Bourque is in there with Larry Robinson and Paul Coffey and two or three others probably from the Golden Era that I'm not
Brad
thinking
Park,
of.
Right, I
Brad
think.
Park, among the non-Bobby Orr defensemen.
Elsewhere on the ice, the International Skating Union announced a new scoring system for figure skating this week. Does this change everything?
Yes, it's the 10-point must system, also known as the three knockdown rule. No, they'll just find a new way to cheat, because I've sat here for 5 minutes reading the news account of this, and I still don't know how it's different. Chuck Foster, luckily, the U.S. Figure Skating Association president, has pointed out that you are no longer placing the skater, you are judging each one in the various elements. It's a new approach to judging, and we feel a better one. Ha! Okay.
Go get him. The Chartered Society of Physiotherapists in Great Britain has issued an injury survival guide for fans watching soccer matches. I suppose it might apply to fans watching any sport on TV. Do you see any especially helpful hints here?
Well, I mean, I understand, and I'm sure they're looking out for our benefit, but one of the suggestions is avoid leaping from the sofa in wild celebration. Suppose you leap from the sofa in moderate celebration.
That would be better, healthier.
Leap from the Barca lounger in wild celebration. Apparently, twice as many patients at this one clinic are injured by sitting in awkward postures as by playing sport. Why can't the British teach their children how to sit?
Last weekend, Charlie Albert Trapasso, a punter on the Ohio State football team, pleaded guilty to underage drinking. Hardly a story there, except that this was apparently the 14th time in the past 3 years that an Ohio State player has found himself before a magistrate. Mr. Trapasso's associates have been involved in drunk driving, assault, robbery, felony drug abuse. How have they had time to play football in Columbus?
Well, the hits just keep on coming. Underage drinking, drunken driving, disorderly conduct, assault, falsification of a police report of theft. Hello, Maurice Clarette. Mm-hmm. Robbery, felony drug abuse, and carrying a concealed weapon, hopefully not all at the same time. Which leads us to another story.
Yes, indeed. On Tuesday, Ohio State fired the men's basketball coach, Jim O'Brien. What was his offense?
He gave money to a recruit and acknowledged that he had given money to a recruit, and that can't stand. My point being, how does Ohio State football coach Jim Tressel still have a job, considering he's running the Gambino family in his program, apparently?
Finally, Charlie, Ed Burke, a listener from Keene, New Hampshire, wrote this week to say that among the players drafted by Major League Baseball in their annual draft were Richard Bambino and William Mays. I like their chances.
Well, you know, William Mays is the one that intrigues me, because you wonder if the kids he grew up with are aware enough to make fun of him because his name means something. You think the kids know who Willie Mays was? I doubt it.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time to feast on my batting practice fastballs. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Recent developments in worldwide track and field competition may have marked the end of 31-year-old Haile Gebrselassie's decade-long domination of middle-distance running. But as Only a Game's Karen Given reports, it's not quite time to count him out in sports or elsewhere.
Away they go.
3 years ago, Haile Gebrselassie predicted his training partner, Kenenisa Bekele, would soon pass him by. On Tuesday, the eclipse was complete.
And we are looking at the future of world distance running. He could dominate this young man for another 6 or 8 years, possibly longer. The days of Haile Gebrselassie have come and gone, and we are seeing here the dawning of a totally new era.
9 days after besting Gebrselassie's 5,000-meter record by more than 2 seconds, Bekele took on his mentor's last remaining world record, the 10,000 meters at Ostrava in the Czech Republic. The moment was broadcast live to Europe and the internet by Eurosport.com.
And surely he's going to do it. 18, 19, 20. He's there. The world record is gone. 26, 20 for Kenenisa Bekele. Here in Ostrava tonight, he breaks.
Gebre Selassie was undoubtedly paying attention as Bekele crossed the finish line, but it's hard to imagine him ever worrying about such things. After all, when asked at a January press conference in Boston, Gebre Selassie couldn't even list the number of world records he's held.
It's 18 or 17. I don't know exactly. It's 18 or 17. He doesn't know exactly. Well, he's in good company because nobody else does either.
For the record, he's held 18. And later, with his quick, broad smile, Gebre Selassie admits he knew the answer all along. Gebre Selassie's life has been the stuff movies are made of. He grew up poor. His mother died when he was 7, his older sister when he was 15. School was 6 miles away, the nearest water 2 miles, and running was Gebre Selassie's transportation. His father, a farmer, believed athletics was a frivolous pursuit in a country where millions were dying of famine. In 2002, Gebre Selassie told the Times of London, "All I had was running. I just ran and ran all the time, and I got better and better." Gebre Selassie still loves to run in the countryside, but now he's not alone.
When I pass by, if they know it's Haile Gebrselassie, look at this Haile, come on, just... Many kids, you know, they follow, you know, like, they come and just, you know, they chill me, Haile, Haile. You know, this, some kids, they run far from their house, and I have to stop them, you know, somewhere, just, no, I'm going far, stay here and back home, and back to your father or mother, don't come farther.
Those kids who follow you on the street, are you ever worried that they're going to run faster than you?
Yes, they are already. I'm trying to keep what the woman they have. Of course, it's not easy. I'm trying.
For many, the end of the Gebre Selassie era came when Bekele outsprinted his legend in the 10,000 meters at last year's World Championship in Paris. But Gebre Selassie's just happy it was a fellow Ethiopian who brought an end to his decade at the top.
First, you have to think about country, then come for myself. We Ethiopians, you know, just we need to show a good image of our country by sport, because, you know, most of the world, you know, they know Ethiopia as a country with problems like famine, drought, and war, something like that. But this time, of course, you know, we have a good part. Sport is one of our good part, and also our country, it's improving, and soon, you know, we will become special again.
Helping make his country special again takes every bit as much of Gebre Selassie's time as training and racing. He's a UN ambassador working against the spread of AIDS. He's raised the money to build 3 schools for children in Ethiopia and plans many more. With an income of well over $1 million a year, he invests in businesses where success is measured in numbers of homes built, people employed, and foreign companies encouraged to do business in Ethiopia. Many call for the runner to enter a different kind of race altogether, but Gebre Selassie isn't so sure.
A question is, you know, what kind of training I need for politics? You see, sport and politics is a different thing. If there is a possibility, I'll try.
All the way to president someday?
Why not? Why not?
Some would say Gebre Selassie already has an advantage over the incumbent. Gareth Davies is a sports journalist for the London Daily Telegraph.
He is probably the most famous person in Ethiopia. I think inside and outside. You ask most people in the street, they won't know the name of the Ethiopian president. Do you know? I don't even know the name of the Ethiopian president. I think he's called Haile Gebre Selassie.
For the moment, Ethiopia is led by Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. But should Gebre Selassie ever decide to displace him, he already has a home worthy of a head of state. Soon after he moved into his new estate in Addis Ababa last month, Gebre Selassie invited Davies and a group of journalists over for lunch.
I think he had this built because he wants to be able to invite people there who have influence, who he can influence for the betterment of his country. I would call it an ambassadorial palisette, in which it's got a lovely garden, it's got colonnades modelled from the Acropolis, it's got marble on every floor. There was a bust of him in the doorway, which hadn't found a home yet. There's something enigmatic about him, because there's this palace he's walking around in, and he's in a tracksuit and a pair of training shoes. And I don't think he's ever out of a tracksuit, Haile, you know?
Gebre Selassie graciously served his visitors lunch, then coffee, in his downstairs coffee bar. He has a way of putting people at ease, including his countrymen, who are known to refer to him as the Emperor. Davies admits the hardest part of the assignment was writing a story that didn't make Gebre Selassie out to be a saint.
I think he's inspirational more than saintly. I mean, God, he probably has the odd row with his wife when he's stressed. He is something special. Maybe not a saint, but he is something extra special. And I think when someone realizes the impact they can have on their own society and manages to have no arrogance about them, you can only stand back and admire, you know.
It's clear that the crowd at January's Boston Indoor Games admires Gebre Selassie. The 4,000-seat stadium is overflowing with fans, many of whom drape themselves in the green, yellow, and red of the Ethiopian flag. As time for Gebre Selassie's race approaches, Haile's fans can barely contain their excitement.
Hey, guys! Do you know what race is next?
At 5'3", Gebre Selassie looks impossibly small on the starting line. Even though he's been having trouble at shorter distances, he's promised the crowd he'll make an attempt on the 3,000-meter indoor record. Gebre Selassie seems to glide more than run across the starting line and into the front of the pack. As he passes the mile mark in 3 minutes 59 seconds, Gebre Selassie is still smiling. He's still smiling, too, when he crosses the finish line well behind world record pace. No one seems to notice that Gebre Selassie failed to hit his mark, or maybe they just don't care. In between excited cell phone calls to fans in other cities, Tomrat, an Ethiopian who's been living in Boston for just over 2 years, explains his devotion to Gebre Selassie.
It means he's a hero. You know, he's proud of us. We're proud of him, too. That's it.
And you're very happy right now.
I'm very so happy.
Gebre Selassie plans to hang up his middle-distance running shoes after the Athens Olympics and focus his efforts on the marathon, a distance optimists say he has the potential to dominate well into his 30s, leaving those who wish to vote highly for president to wait until he's finished running. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Haile Gebre Selassie, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from San Diego Padres radio host Ernie Martinez.
David Wells is a huge part of this team.
In the nearly 11 years Only a Game has been on the air, I don't think we've ever had a final word that required no punchline until now. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.